You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to another Fireside Chat. I am your host, Lance White. Tonight's guest is Robert Ojato. Robert is a renowned writer, teacher, professional, intuitive consultant, and astrologer. He is also the author of the newly released book, Transforming Fate into Destiny. Robert spent his collegiate years immersed in the study of mythology, Christian mysticism, Kabbalah, Jungian psychology, Buddhism, Eastern philosophy, and Western Hermetic teachings. It was also during college that Robert discovered and began an intensive study of astrology, which has been an ongoing passion for nearly 16 years. He has taught various forms of yoga and Buddhist meditation in Chicago. Robert brought his expertise with intuitive astrology to Carolyn Miss's CMED Institute in Chicago and taught regularly with her on her course, Sacred Contracts. Since then, Robert has founded his own Ananki Apollo Institute, I hope I said that right, of intuitive, archetypal, and astrological studies. So let's welcome this multifaceted, multidimensional being to the show now. Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Oh, wonderful. Well, you've had quite a spiritual path, haven't you?
I've made the rounds.
So is this your last soul life now? Is this the number nine, or are you,
planning? I'll be back again and again, I'm sure of that.
Oh, well, to this place?
I don't know. One never knows.
One never knows, I know. So I ask myself the same question. So how did your quest of spirituality begin? Were you always interested in these subjects, or were you an outcast, or did you get hit by a bolt of lightning, or what?
No bolts of lightning, but I think it was a very organic process. I think I remember being very young and always having a kind of an insight into life always being more philosophically oriented. And then when I was 19, it really kicked back into gear when I entered my collegiate years. So that's when it really probably got more conscious and became more of a conscious path for me.
Well, maybe you could be young enough to be an indigo kid.
I would say I'm probably bridging that generation. I think that my awakenings were kind of gradual and still are in terms of my own spiritual growth and development and coming into, you know, a greater consciousness of the soul's journey.
You do believe that we choose and pick some of our experiences here on Earth prior to incarnating into this experience.
Absolutely. What I do as an intuitive, there's two halves to me, kind of, that I merge together. One's the intuitive half and one's the astrologer half. And the intuitive half is actually exactly that, coming into an understanding of the soul's intention and what one is working with in this lifetime as ways to catalyze greater consciousness and explore the mystery of our divinity and who we are. So to do that, we need to choose certain setups for our own expansion, and I believe that, I call it your cosmic contract, it's this agreement you make with fate and destiny to come into an experience of the world, and you get, you know, this hand of cards dealt to you, which becomes your fate, and then destiny becomes how through the consciousness of your soul that you play out that hand and then, you know, orchestrate a life. So both are important.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you on that one. I personally believe that I chose my parents, but not everybody will ascribe to that belief, and maybe some people do choose them and some people don't. How do you feel about that one?
I think everybody does choose their parents, actually, and I know that when people are having a difficult time, in my experience, really kind of digesting that. It's usually because they come from a very difficult background where their parents might have been pretty awful sometimes to them. And,
yeah.
you know,
that's
actually true of me as well. I grew up in a very challenged home with two alcoholic parents, and there was abuse and all sorts of other things going on. So,
I
relate to the difficulty of kind of embracing that. But at the same time, you know, we can't live in a world where we say there aren't any accidents and then say, oh, but that was an accident, you know.
Right.
You know, and we have
right.
to, I think, kind of embrace that, you know, much to our ego's chagrin, we do make these decisions before we come here that once we're here, you know, aren't very fun. But that's part of the fate, destiny trajectory. You have to kind of embrace it. And I think, you know, what will block people from seeing that element of their cosmic contract is their victim consciousness, you know, if they're feeling victimized by the world or not. So.
Yeah. I was listening to your YouTube video today. In fact, I sent it to my Yahoo group. And about victimhood and stuff, and you—I mean, you're right on the money on everything that you say, as far as I can tell. And you know, I've dabbled a little bit in most of the things that you've studied, probably more deeply than me. But yes, you know, my parents were both either bisexual. One was a closeted homosexual, gay.
Wow.
And alcoholic, but there was a lot of fun in it too. I mean, there were some fun times from. You know, friends that came up from Hollywood and crazy people and stuff like that. So it was kind of like a C version of anti-MAME. The cheap version, you know, the low-budget version. And so once I kind of figured out that I chose these situations, that this was part of what I came into because it would offer me the most experience to grow from, then, of course, it removes the whole burden of blame and victimhood, and you are taking responsibility for your own experiences.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's really important, too, because you can't get to destiny until you get to, which is your real vitalizing role in the world of purpose, mm-hmm. until you confront that victim piece of your life path. And if you sit and bemoan and sort of blame the universe for bad parents or whatever it is, that comes on your path, you know, you're going to miss out on what you're really here to do, which is serve other people through your unique gifts and skills. And that's what makes destiny, you know, animate and energize is being able to really get beyond that place where we come from a sense of we've been victimized. And, you know, and certainly we all are entitled, I think, to a pity party every now and then around what happens in life, for God's sakes. But if you stay at the pity party, you know, you're going to miss out. So the point is to make sense, make meaning of it, you know, and make your suffering sacred, and then move through that and begin to, you know, embrace what it's pointing you toward in terms of your life's purpose.
Oh, absolutely. And you also talk about the shadow side. I'm sure you mention all of these things in your book. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to read it, but we'll be talking about, you know, the ideas that, you know, that you've generated. And I'm sure that everybody will be interested in finding out more.
Sure.
So the shadow side is important, too, to become familiar with and to, you know, to at least know and let up and release.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually what I find so fascinating is that in our contemporary spirituality and self-help culture, the shadow piece is the most neglected and needs the most integration, because we think that if we see something negative or bad in who we are, then we are bad. And rather than realizing that it's when we look at our woundedness and our lack of esteem and our ways of berating ourselves and being so harsh with ourselves, through that we get the option and choice to make different choices in our life path, rather than be compelled to act out of our shadow and try to fight for, you know, this sense of empowerment that really isn't going to really satiate the need to really get deep with the soul and would get what I call soul esteem on board, which is really knowing that you have worth just because you're breathing. You don't have to be better or do anything. You just have to embrace, like Buddha would say, that you already are Buddha. You just got to wake up to it, you know, and really be conscious of that.
Well, then where does this this deep sense of feeling like we're here to do something, we're on a mission, come from? I mean, isn't that is that part of the ingrained soul contract that we
Yeah,
make?
There's something in our soul's code, I think, that says we're here to explore ourselves in a certain pattern and life path. And in the language of astrology, that would be very much represented to some extent by the sun sign you have. I see that not as what you innately are, but what your soul's working with is a life path and a pattern in development of consciousness. But
okay.
at the same time, we have to be conscious of our culture kind of pressuring us into this idea as well that, you know, you've got to do such and such to finally be somebody. And realize that we already are somebody, you know. And,
all
you got to do is express that. What we're called to do is express that into the world, not achieve that in the world. And so it's about, rather than, you know, perfectionism, you know, which is a big cultural issue, this idea we have to be better, which is an aspiration toward, you know, becoming something more. It's rather the revelation of what you already are and expressing that in some meaningful way, I think, in your life's journey. That's how I see it, because I think when you get into that mode of, you know, there's that urge in our soul to kind of keep moving and experiencing life. I think the soul's here for experience and not security. So, you know, it pushes you on and wants you to engage different adventures and all these things, but maybe not the way we're kind of ingrained by our culture and our family to do that. I think it's more of a flow of expression and exploring our own self, you know, our own being, and then allowing
without that limitations.
And
without fear.
Exactly. So when you create from that space a life, it's much. That's the destined life, you know. And it doesn't mean you don't have obstacles. It just means that you understand that they're part of the path. They're part of what's propelling, you know, this expression of your soul into the world. And obstacles are necessary. They kind of make the soul buoy up and kind of come into your life and kind of show you, in the end, I think, the enormous beauty of who you are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we have so many people on the planet now, we're going to have obstacles just from the sheer size of our ability to reproduce.
It's a fascinating time for everybody that's here on the planet right now, and I believe everyone's, you know, of course, forged an agreement to be here right now. It's a fascinating time to be alive, because we are such a crucial crossroads in, you know, human development on the planet, and it's equally as perilous. I mean, it's fascinating and perilous at the same time, but I think that that's why we really have to engage this idea of destiny with new vigor and with new concentration. Because each of us has, I know this to be true, a unique aspect of why we're here that we're meant to deliver to each other in service. And if we really begin to consciously tap into that and bring that forward, then it would be a destined world. We'd have more destiny and less fate going on in the world. And I think that's kind of, in an overall global template, what we're at a fate-destiny point, I call it, where, you know, because I think we can create our own fate. You know, we can create our own limits and our own consequence to our own consciousness, through what you were saying earlier, through fear, through you know, not really connecting with the integrity of the soul, you know. And when you're not connected to that, you're going to think that, you know, you've got to disempower other people to be empowered, or, you know, do things to the environment to have success and abundance that are negative and toxic for the environment, you know. And a new paradigm has to somehow begin to flip the balance here.
Well, now, since you are aware of astrology, many people, many people are pointing to the idea that there are some major galactic events coming up, and some of them are occurring in 2012.
Right.
Do you follow any of that information that
accompanies? Oh, yeah, sure. You know, and here's the thing that I like to educate people on around astrology is that there's this notion that's very medieval in that the planets cause things to happen, and I really disagree with that, because if we're going to start talking about quantum physics and archetypes and living in a quantum and archetypal world, then we understand we're co-creating reality, you know. And that said, we bring in this concept of synchronicity. The planets, astrology is brilliant. It's like a clock. I mean, if you really understand how to work with it, it's something that it's very empiric in that sense that you can watch cycles happen and watch events happen completely resonant with that cycle and just shake your head and go, wow, there is a design to this creative matrix that we call Earth School, and things happen in this sort of rhythmic, cyclical, creative way. Absolutely. But the planets are mirroring a synchronicity. You know, they're not causing anything. I don't see it as causative. It's more that they're mirroring processes that are happening on the planet that are also happening in us. What the ancients were doing was projecting their interiors onto the stars, you know, and externalizing the inner creative pantheon of the gods and goddesses and constellations, you know. So if we understand that now, then we have to say, wow, well, you know, there is a fate and destiny. The fate is, you know, the planets are where they are, and they're in the archetypal energy that they are, and they're mirroring that. We can't change that. But the destiny is, well, how do we want to work with that and engage that consciously? So there definitely are cycles right now mirroring back to us some pretty big stuff. And, you know, the Mayan calendrix, which is the 2012 end date, is a different system. But it's, once again, a synchronicity talking about the ending of one way of us, I think, engaging reality and having to now rebirth a new one. So it's an ending, yes, but it's also a beginning. And I think we have to focus on both aspects of it, that something does have to die for us to move forward. And I think it's very interesting that 2012 is also an election year, and there's a lot going on in the world. I mean, if you start to connect the synchronicities up, you go, wow, there's a lot transitioning that year alone that, you know, is going to come to call.
Isn't there a grand cross in the planets at that time as well? And plus, we tip into the galactic plane, which is unusual for
the galactic
center.
There's a lot going on, but once again, it's a synchronicity of the sort of archetypal creative tension in the global psyche that is trying to integrate. You know, it's all kind of bringing up this integrative process. And oftentimes, before something integrates, there has to be sort of a war or a battle of some kind, in which the energies exhaust, and then a new solution has to be kind of sought out from a different vantage point where these things can start working harmoniously. So I think there will be, I know there will be, but it's already happening, massive changes coming up. I mean, astrologers were talking about Pluto, which just went into the sign Capricorn this last year, about, you know, what that would bring. And it's brought everything we all thought it would. It's brought an economic death that we're experiencing right now. It's brought a challenge of our resources because, you know, the Earth is not limitless in its resources. I mean, it's completely forcing on us, which Pluto does because it deals with the shadow. It's forcing on us our own shadow and all the unconsciousness that we've been engaged in the last, certainly 8 years, but even, you know, up until this point. I mean, I think it goes even back further. It's, you know, it just kind of exacerbated and came out in a more extreme way with recent policies and I think, you know, decisions by our government and also, you know, the way that resources are going. All these things are converging into this new reckoning that we have to look at and say, well, if we're going to get to the next place with ourselves, well, we're going to have to assess the shadow of our own culture, of our own nation, of our own world, you know.
Absolutely. And it seems like, as you said, this goes back much further.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe
hundreds of
thousands of years.
Absolutely.
You know,
and what's really fascinating is, like, for example, everything has a birth chart. So we could even say that the United States has its own birth chart. And in the natal chart of which is the birth chart of the United States, Pluto is coming all the way back to where it was when this country was born. And I always say to people, you know, we have a shadow as a nation, and that doesn't mean I don't love my country, but it means that I also can see very clearly that, wow, for us to be here, hundreds and thousands of Native Americans were slaughtered. I mean, so, we have to kind of look at the fact that we have a shadow side, and I think that kind of ambitious negative aspects of the Capricorn energy, which brought our nation into being, have now got to be integrated in some way, because they're still functioning as creative processes in our own ways of living, and you know, so it's all coming full circle, and we're being asked to, I think, renegotiate the way we're co-creating our lives here. You know, and everybody
absolutely.
Right now is going through that. They're asking themselves, "What's really meaningful for me? You know, what do I really need to not only survive but just be okay?" You know, and it's interesting when you start to really pare it down and realize what's really important. It's not what you usually think it is. So, lots of changes.
Well, it does seem to that it gets down to our you know, to basically it boils down to love.
Yes.
You know,
let's not forget love. Yes.
You know, in all its various forms, it seems to be one of the highest forms of expression that I can tell.
Absolutely.
You know, because without it, you have no conscience, and then, you know, when you turn over your power to others, then they're glad to have it, you know, and they've been taking it for quite a long time. I mean, we have a shadow government, and we have a ruling elite, and who knows what other ooga-boogas are going on out there. But, you know, there's lots of conspiracy theorists that have a pretty good idea about it, and that all has to come to light.
Absolutely, and the thing about love that I think is really key is that, you know, in our world, we live in a world, and it's the nature of creation here, that's dualistic. We have, you know, polarities, and we have duality. We have light, dark, you know, night, day, good, evil, all these positive, negative, ugly, pretty, you know, all these things in this world that give us contrast so our soul can engage free will and make decisions. But love is the one energy that sort of unifies it all. And it brings it into a sense of it's all of the divine. You know, it's all of God, if you will, or the goddess, or whatever you want to call it, Buddha, the universe. It's all of that source of energy. And love is that, and this is a love that isn't, you know, Hollywood, you know, kind of romantic. This is something that transcends that, that is a unifying energy and force that is the root of who we really are. And, absolutely, and that's what has to be, and that's what the soul is about, is, you know, the soul sees the connections of things in the ego, and it's divorced from the soul form, is more about disconnections of things and having to get that kind of power through that fear.
Yes,
and love
absolutely.
Is the one thing that satiates that and gives us a sense of, no, it's all happening as it should, and I'm on a path, and I have a purpose, and I have worth, and, you know, it's that tapping into that energy. Absolutely. I love that you said that.
Well, you know, and plus you start to realize once you get to a certain point that, you know, what you do to somebody else, you're really doing to yourself.
Exactly.
I mean, almost literally, we are literally each other.
Absolutely.
So when you look at all the wars and the way that we act towards one another, we're literally creating a world of horror, and it's going to come back to us, even if it looks like, you know, it's somebody else out there, you know, it's them, you know, it's those people in that other country, or it's this or that or the other thing. You can't be killing people and torturing and raping and maiming and stealing and cheating and all that, lying, and not have that come back and bite you in the ass.
Absolutely, and that's the thing, is that when you're in your soul, when you're in the deepest root of your being, when you see someone homeless, that's you that's homeless that you're looking at. You know, and that's where we're so disconnected. We think that what's happening in Darfur doesn't matter to us, and it should. It absolutely should, because that's happening because we collectively are allowing it. You know, and then we feel so powerless. It's like, well, how can we stop it? How can we stop it? And, you know, it has to start with all of us kind of realizing, wow, that's actually us over there getting slaughtered right now. And take action in whatever ways we can. I mean, obviously, you know, we're limited in our capacity to, you know, do certain things, and that has to be acknowledged. But I think it is about, you know, coming back to the soul and doing what you're called to do. You know, like, what are you called to do with who you are? You know, and that might be, you know, volunteering at your local animal shelter, advocating for, you know, homeless people in your local community or something. I mean, it might be something very different, but it all connects and matters. And that's what brings you a sense, I think, of true satisfaction with being alive.
Yeah,
service.
Absolutely. And also, I think we're reaching into a point where I think people are going to realize, as they always do when we're pushed against the wall, that it's so much more powerful and so much more moving and rewarding to help other people in need, because there are going to be so many people in need that we're going to have to band together and really help each other out through some difficult moments.
We really are. I mean, there's
intensities are popping up all over the place.
Yeah, and
I don't think.
I agree with you. I don't think we're going to get out of this, you know, this financial stuff. I actually get the sense that it'll be around the time the next election cycle comes up that things start to get a little better.
I know. Me too.
But it's okay. I mean, it's what we need to learn, and it's where we are. And I think in the end, it all comes full circle to what it needs to be for us to grow in our collective soul. But it's a challenging time. It really is. It's one of the challenges. I think it's, you know, we're at a crucial fate destiny point. You know, what we decide actually the next 4 years. That's why I think the Mayans were tapping into that. What we decide in the next 4 years determines the next cycle for our humanity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and certainly for this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with you. And so it's important to choose our thoughts and our words wisely, I would think. In our actions.
I definitely think, Yeah, and what we're doing and being aware of, you know, are you really, you know, so many people obviously when they come to me for a reading or even buy one of my books or any book in spirituality and self-help, they're seeking for something. And I think that what I've learned thus far on this path of life is that, you know, what we're seeking is how can you serve? How can you serve others? You know, because I know for me that's when I feel the most alive is when I'm helping someone else and connecting to them and they, you know, and it's not just about this sort of unfortunate capitalist orientation to spirituality where it's about getting more stuff and energizing through the law of attraction more stuff. And, you know, it's more about, well, how can I express my love into the world and helping other people? And that's really one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book I wrote, Transforming Fate into Destiny, was to kind of counterbalance some of where I saw things in this field of spirituality and self-help that, to me, were off the mark a little, you know, and had great elements of certain things, but yet were not quite on the mark in terms of what I would say, you know, a purposeful and destined life's really about via the work that I do and what I've discovered in my own life and working with clients.
Can you give an example or two of that?
Of
what you just said?
What did I say? well, you know, yeah, sure. I think that there's a lot of people that think that destiny is about security and trying to arrive at some promised land mode of security and being whole. And, you know, I don't think we're ever really whole. It's part of the sort of human wound we have that propels us to keep searching for that, and that's how it should be. But you'll never know all your mysteries. You'll never know, you know, why things happen all the time as they do. And I think at the same time, to limit your sense of purpose to your job exclusively or to whether or not you can energize on your vision board, you know, all your goals, all that kind of stuff. Because you have to go to a different place in yourself and think, well, what's really motivating me to put this on a vision board? Is it coming from my deeper self or is it coming from my ego? And then we have to ask ourselves, well, where are we deriving our worth? Are we exclusively bound to what culture is telling us about ourselves? Or are we able to really stand in our own authority and say, well, this is who I feel I am in my authenticity, you know? And it's a constant dialogue. I don't think you're ever done with this process of staying conscious, you know, and trying to be as aware as you can. And then it's also about compassion. You know, we're all flawed and frail, and the human journey is, you know, as Buddha would say, full of suffering. And you know, but out of all that, we got to somehow, you know, find that center point of true, authentic compassion for each other, and bring our gifts forward. I've done hundreds and thousands of readings on people, and you know, a common element that everybody's, I think, dealing with is first, you know, breaking free from family patterning, but second, what I recognize most in people nowadays is we've done a lot of family work. We've all done, I think, some element or measure of family therapy, but what we haven't done is really assess the cultural spells we're under and the ways that we believe about ourselves in our culture and society. So, for example, a lot of my clients are women, and we're in a patriarchal society that inherently tells them they're less than men. And in so many different ways, it's unfathomable. But nonetheless, women will also, as do many people, replicate their own oppression and not even be aware of it, you know, and get in this process of sort of suppressing and repressing their own worth and value. And at the end of the day, always, always, always coming back to men for approval. You know, and it's fascinating how we all are, I think we're all, you know, oppressing ourselves in some capacity, and then you become more aware, and you're like, wow, I was really under this belief that blah, blah, blah about myself because of what this society tells me. I think we're confronting that. Like, for example, in your history, you know, what would have maybe prevented, you said your father was gay, I mean, prevented him from being himself.
Because
a culture that's saying that's wrong, you know, and that's bad. And it was his nature and his contract to experience consciousness in that way.
That's right, and then he found religion, and that made it even worse.
Spiritualize it away,
and you can't do that.
It goes into the shadow and gets more momentum, you know, and then sabotages you, fates you even more.
Yeah, and then I took the ball and ran with it, since neither one of my parents were able to express it fully, so I just, you know, I just went to Hollywood and turned gay. and did all the things that my parents didn't get a chance to do. So, but that had its own consequences in, abuse and drugs and, nightmares of problems, which eventually, you know, I did come around and overcome. But it is a long process.
Yeah, definitely. And, absolutely.
And then living with HIV and AIDS is another, you know, that's another little challenge that I picked up along the way.
Right.
So these are all things that are learning experiences.
Right. And that's part of your path. I mean, and then you have to have compassion for your own process, because no, I mean, we're not really taught how to do that. I don't think in our culture, you know, how to have compassion for your own process. It's always about comparing yourself to someone else, and you know, where am I compared to so and so? And you know, especially in your journey, I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of many emotions to get through on the path
of God.
Self-acceptance from, you know, God. I can just go down the list.
it's endless.
Endless, yeah.
And then when you think you've reached the, you know, you finally have some self-esteem and self-love, and you've gone to all the ASS seminars and done the Advocate Experience and gone through this and that and the other thing, then you find out, oh, there's another layer of self-loathing that I have to work through.
I hear you.
And it's like, oh, my God, I thought I was through that.
Isn't that something?
No.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, I feel your pain. I think that's true, and that's actually, I'm working on another book already, and that's kind of touching into the subject of my next book. I want to address deepening into the concept of what I brought into my first book called Soul Esteem. You know, it's one thing we can talk about our divine worth, and you know, that we all have value, and that we have value because we're from the divine and we're from God, whatnot. But what does that really mean when you're out in the world living and, you know, trying to really actually embody that worth? What does it really take? You know, because we can talk about it until the cows come home, and we can all resonate and go, oh, yeah. But, you know, what does it mean when you leave your front door? You know, and so I want to explore that in much more kind of honesty and just, you know, practicality as well. Like, how do you practically really live your value in the world? Because I think that's an ongoing challenge for everybody. I don't know of anybody that doesn't have that challenge. You know, no matter how successful they are, no matter what.
But yeah, you almost have to leave your front door with a machete to chop through all the judgment and fear. You know, I mean, you've got all the religions, you know, coming down on you for this, for you know, that and the other thing, and you know, telling you that you're bad, wrong, and should be living in burning flames, you know?
Absolutely, yeah, no.
Before you can even think about existing, you have to cut through all of that bullshit.
Right, right.
So that's a lot of stuff to get through, you know, on a societal level.
Well, and most of my clients, this brings up another interesting point of the types of clients I draw in, because I think that if you fit a tribal sort of societal standard, a lot of times the detriment of that is that you don't ever ask deeper questions about the reality and nature of consciousness and what your life's about, because you already kind of fit a mold and you just go on autopilot to what the expectations of the environment are for you. But when you don't fit it, when you're gay, lesbian, African-American, Native American, or minority of some kind, or just, you know, never quite feel internally like you fit, whatever it is, the gift in that, and I call it the orphan archetype, is that you get the opportunity to create reality on your own terms. You don't have to go through the tribal mind to kind of ask the questions you want to ask. And so the detriment, though, is that alienation, that sense of, well, I don't, you know, and then, of course, if you don't find an inner compass or an inner source of value for yourself, you're still going to always feel that kind of lack of acceptance and worth and stuff, which I think so many people still, even though they might be like yourself on a spiritual path and have grown, and they still suffer that kind of wound in them that never really is healed or satiated. And that's kind of what I want to do with this book, because I realize that so many of my clients are those people, you know, that are kind of in some way, they're not fitting the mold, and so they're looking for different coordinates for their purpose. Like, you know, Robert, give me the coordinates, give me the contract. What did I agree to, for God's sake? You know,
right.
And then you want to, you know, try to piece it together and get some meaning going, and that's, you know, pretty much the job I do. But yeah, absolutely, I think that's really crucial because I've seen then at the same time communities forming around those wounds and then, once again, replicating their own oppression, you know. So, for example, many gay men who are told by culture that they're nothing but sexual beings and that's bad in the way that they are sexual beings, they'll instead of pursuing themselves in a heart chakra kind of way with their sexuality, they kind of just stay in a second chakra and that's all they do, you know. And they become essentially what society's labeled them as and not even realize that they're replicating their own oppression and not engaging in more authentic relationship and eros with each other, you know, which
right.
eros
Absolutely.
In Greek mythology is about relationship, you know, and this sort of spiritual dynamic. So, you know, it gets really, I think, fascinating to look at them from that it's like, or like an African American who becomes a gangbanger and thinks that's empowerment, you know, when they've become what, you know, a lot of society would just say, that's all you are, you know, and that's all you'll ever be. And so it's interesting, I think, to peel back that layer and really look at the shadow, and not in a way where we diminish ourselves, but rather we get the opportunity to get our buried treasure back, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I like the way you say that.
Because we do, that's the thing about, and this is something I'm bringing up in the next book, we tend to think if you know, well, that we can't see these things, and if we do, well, you know, even like certain communities don't want to look at themselves and take their own inventory because, oh, we're barely getting a little power as it is, you know?
Right.
They don't want to go there, and I think
that's
actually important because that's actually the key to completely breaking down the paradigm. I mean, for example, what if gay men just finally said, you know what, I'm not going to go to the straight heterosexual culture for my approval anymore. I'm going to embody my sexuality the way I want to in an authentic way that feels right for me. And fine, you don't want me to get married? I won't get married. I'll have my own commitment ceremony. I'll do my own thing. You know, I'm not going through your approval system anymore. You know, it would be a completely different dynamic. Or women with men, you know, same thing. I'm not going through your approval system anymore. I'm going to create my own beauty standard. No more Botox and boob implants, you know? And that's a fascinating thing to think about. I mean, did women really create their own beauty standard? Because I think that what they did is they, on some level, you know, let that go to the hands of men who said, well, this is what we find beautiful, and if you want a validation from us, this is what you must accomplish as a body image. And can women look at that honestly and say, well, gosh, you know, I'm not really the one putting the Botox in. It's really the guy sitting next to me that wants me to look like I'm 20 forever. You know, there's so many things that I think we got to start looking at in our culture around that.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And, of course, you know, I think maybe partially because of my age, I mean, I'm 59 turning 60, I tend to look at, you know, what can I contribute now? I mean, this is a time when it's much more important to be sensitive to the needs of, you know, the world and to give back some of the stuff that I feel I've taken or given or, I mean, taken or had shared by other people that I respect, my teachers and so on and so forth, and how can I give that back to other people? And I think that's just a natural process as we get a little bit older.
Well, in the archetype of elderhood, absolutely. And that even that process hasn't been honored because we tell people as they get older they lose value to us, and I think that's such a sad thing. And there's such opportunity for you to really explore that and become the mentor, you know, especially to, in your community, the gay community.
Right.
I mean, the gay youth out there that might be looking for that kind of mentorship and just guidance, which is sorely lacking in my experience with within that community.
Yeah, and there seems to be a schism, too, between the youth and the age and the older. It's kind of like this new generation that's sprung up is kind of, you know, well, now they're doing their own thing, and the ones who might be able to share something of interest that might help them a little bit, they're kind of excluded and kind of forced out of the scene, you know. And plus, I think marketing and all of that and the falseness of the society we're in that's so greedy, it's just kind of taken over all the consumerism. And everybody's supposed to be beautiful and, you know, have the perfect lives, and it just seems to be an increasingly fast rat cage that we're in, you know.
And it's all an illusion, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Who really has that life? You know, that's what I think is fascinating, too. You know, we can project onto celebrities or people that have perhaps a lot of money that they are happy, and I think that's absolutely not the case at all. I mean, I know people that are very wealthy, but boy, you know, they struggle with lots of different things that are pretty serious in some cases, you know. So, I think it's that's what I'm seeing, you know, when we talk about, you know, 2012 and all the cycles we're in. I mean, this is the stuff that's coming up. This is what's on the horizon.
Yeah.
The event horizon is bringing this stuff to the fore because the soul's wanting, I mean, the opportunity at hand in our current crises is that the soul gets a doorway open to come in deeper to our lives and really express itself in a much richer way into the ways that we create our reality here. And I think that's part of the new emergence of the kind of human consciousness that is in prototype form in what we call the age of Aquarius, you know, in astrology. It's this age where it's commanding and allowing more freedom to be fully expressed in who we are at the level of our soul in our human ego form. And that is, you've got two kind of compasses. One is the ego, one is the soul, and they're kind of in this sort of lockdown and polarized right now. And that brings up the sort of a clash of energy, because you've got the new emerging quantum kind of concept of co-creating reality, and then you've got people thinking life happens and comes at them, you know, and that you've got to get yours to survive. And, you know, and so each of us has it going on inside of us in some measure or another, and I think it's pushing all of us to face our fear, look at what matters, you know, just keep the game of consciousness and the art of consciousness moving forward in each our own way. Mm-hmm. And everybody has a soul schedule. I think it's really important to understand, too, that not everybody's scheduled to evolve to certain levels of consciousness this lifetime. They just aren't. You know, I don't think you can try to tell a fundamentalist Christian they're going to reincarnate, because it'll just fry their brain. You know, they can't take that kind of idea and ground it in their system. It's too much. So, you know, we have to respect other people's paths, but at the same time, advocate for our own.
Yeah, that's really important. You know, I think that you can't stress that enough, that everybody needs to be allowed to walk their own path, because we don't know what another person's feeling, how it feels to feel another person's shoes. And until you've walked in somebody else's shoes, and we probably have in many lifetimes, but until we actually experience it, we don't know what's going on. We don't know what their agreements are, or whether there's karmic implications, or, you know, we just don't know who is behind the mask and why they're doing what they're doing. But we can know for ourselves. And I think that, as you said, going for the highest level of consciousness that we can,
right,
and allowing others to have their experience is really crucial.
Absolutely. We can know for ourselves, and we're called to know for ourselves. You know, I mean,
yes,
part of the pursuit of oneself spiritually is to allow yourself to come to know that. You know, and that's the crucial element of a, you know, spiritual practice and a spiritual pursuit of oneself. It's the fundamental core of it. And then you have to then, you know, realize that you're not going to get all the answers. You have to live them out as you get them, you know, and that's... Intuitive guidance and, I think, soul revelation happens in stages. It doesn't all come at once. And you just keep going step by step, you know, with that, and let your purpose happen.
Yes, and being open to what the universe is, you know, showing you and mirroring back to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. You mentioned the age of Aquarius, and there's a lot of differing opinions about when we're actually in it. Are we in it now?
I love this question. Thanks for asking. No, it's such a great question. Here's the thing. Okay, so the astrological ages are determined in this really kind of complex way I'm not even going to get into, because everyone's brain's going to hurt by the time I'm done, including mine.
Okay.
But the point is, you know, it has to do with what causes the ages to change is the Earth's rotation on its axis. Over thousands of years, it kind of wobbles around. You know, like spinning tops, when you spin them, and then at the very end, they start to lose their momentum, and they start to spin around wider and wider at the top. The North Pole kind of does that, actually, and it's because the gravitational pull of the moon on the Earth, and it causes our orientation to the constellations to shift over thousands of years of time. So, in other words, as we begin to look out, we start to see constellations in different places, and most notably, at the first day of spring, what constellation are we looking at? And that used to be Aries, and that was back when, you know, astrology was, you know 4,000 years ago, coming into a real solid form of a tool. Alexander the Great conquers all these, you know, places and unifies the Babylonians, the Egyptians, and the Greeks with their philosophy of astrology, and voila, we have the beginning of that modern-day astrological model. Well, since then, our orientation shifted, and obviously the way it works is our orientation goes backwards to the zodiac, so we were in Aries, and now we went to Pisces. And here's the thing, we can't really say definitively when one constellation ends and one begins. So, but we say that in astrology that every age lasts about 2,167 years-ish, if you want to go there. And so that said, what I look to more is the energy that's coming into the world, like what's downloading into the Earth's chakra system and into our own consciousness, and how are we manifesting that. And I don't think we're fully out of the age of Pisces, because what happens is there's always a transition phase in which we're definitely in. An age of Aquarian energy, archetypal processes are happening. And what happens in an astrological age is that there's one sort of dominant archetypal motif or pattern that kind of creates in the world. It's not the only pattern, but it's the most dominant one, and it seems to really shift consciousness in a very dominant way. So with Pisces, we had teachers that embodied that, like Buddha, Jesus Christ, many other mystics and saints and monks and all sorts of other things. And now we're moving into this new age. It's definitely happening, but we're still learning Piscean lessons. We still can't forgive each other. We still can't, yoke the ego and soul together in some sort of new conscious way. We're still kind of, and what happens at the transition is that the lessons of the previous age get more intense, more intensified. It electrifies them because they must be integrated in as much as we're capable before the next age.
What happens if they don't?
Well, then it just carries over. Okay. You know, a lot of people took, like, for example, what happened with, for example, Christianity, is that it is a Piscean, well, it should be anyway, a Piscean religion. It should be about forgiveness, non-judgment, you know, all the things that Christ came to teach. And also Christ, by the way, was an advocate of you finding the inner church. He was like, you don't need a church. You just need your breath and sit on a rock. You'll find God.
Yeah.
You know, but what happened was the ego of the papacy interpreted a lot of the Piscean messages in an Aries way, which was the Yahweh kind of damning, wrathful God. And the next thing you know, we've just taken Christ's teachings, interpreted them through the lens of Aries, and then we land at this judgmental, fundamentalist kind of orientation to religion. You know, it becomes
and we've had 2,000 years of horror and
absolutely.
And
burning. So now, you know, we have to kind of look at that and go, well, gosh, we interpret, you know, so similarly, you know, when we just keep integrating, we keep moving forward with our consciousness, and I believe we're leaving the age of the guru and messiah archetypes, and now it's about the age of the teacher and the mystic, in terms of being in the world, not in a monastery, but the teacher that teaches you to go to the inner teacher. You know, it's not that you project your salvation onto someone else anymore. It's rather that you become responsible for the bearing of your own cross.
Yeah.
And so that's really where we're at in the culture, and where we're positioned to move forward from this point on, is to be in that space and kind of embrace that space for ourselves. And, you know, we're doing the best we can, obviously, but, you know, we have to just keep shining the light and being who we are. And you know, as Carl Jung said, enlightenment isn't necessarily about focusing on figures of light. It's making the darkness conscious. I think that's where we're at. Making the darkness conscious frees up a lot of choice, and you get to see where you're sabotaging life and yourself, and then you can choose differently. Otherwise, you're in a compulsion. You're compelled to keep acting out the same stuff and fading yourself, you know, hurting others. And so it's like I said, it's a fascinating time to be on the planet. I mean, and it's equally as difficult and dangerous and scary, and but no other than probably any other time, you know. I mean, but
well, like
Atlanta,
that probably was
the issue
moment.
Now is that, and this is the thing that makes it ups the ante for all of us, is that we live in a nuclear age now, and the stakes are much more intense, and also we really are in an environmental crisis.
Yes, we are.
I think is going to get worse as time goes on, because of, you know, the nature of the ways we've been living, trying to be unconscious.
Well, we've been in major denial and throwing bones over our shoulders.
Absolutely, and that is going to catch up with us before too long. I mean, it's just inevitable. It's just the natural course of how I think things go. You know, that's what the shadow is. It's what you try to stay unconscious of. You know, Hades, which is the Greek name for Pluto, who is the lord of the underworld, which is the shadow realm, that means the unseen one. It's what we don't want to see or what we don't see in ourselves, you know. And so it's important to want to open your eyes, you know, and be willing to look at that. And know that it won't diminish you to see your shadow. It'll actually give you much treasure and the possibility, I think, of making some different decisions.
And it's empowering, ultimately.
Ultimately, absolutely. And healing and cathartic and, you know, all of that. It's renewing. It rebirths you. It, you know, it burns you up, though, too. You know? Something gets killed off.
Yeah, and the difference is, you know, if we don't look at ourselves truthfully and honestly and tell ourselves the truth, then we're basically we're nailing our feet to the floor. And we're stuck in, in just repeating cycles of lessons, which tend to get more extreme as time passes, I think.
That's right, they do. They do because, you know, what we resist, as they say, persists. And not only does it do that, it does intensify, it gathers even more momentum. And then becomes an even greater sabotaging force in our process of trying to, you know, live life to its fullest. And, and that's the benefit of doing shadow work. I think that, you know, Carl Jung, whom I love, obviously said, you know, those who stand closest to the light cast the biggest shadows. And I think what he meant by that, from my point of view, was the more that we become conscious, the more let's say enlightened we become and soulful we become, our capacity to do damage in the world also increases through our own unconsciousness. Mm. And so, you know, a shadow process, a shadow way of living life through this point of view of a constant, diligent way of being with ourselves is so crucial to a spiritual path. Because
absolutely.
You can really, you know, mess with someone's soul once you become more, I think, capable, you know, of negotiating your journey. So it's important. These are all important, I think, dynamics that we all are going to be confronting in ourselves and in our collective consciousness over, gosh, the next 10, 20 years. It's going to be interesting.
It definitely will be. You know, if we're going to make it that long, my goodness.
I have faith in humanity. I think we will. But I think we will. But it won't come without a cost, and it won't come without doing some hardcore work. And, you know, the other thing that's happening now that has not happened on the planet, in recorded history at least, is we're globalizing. I mean, we have an internet. We have all these different things that previously we did not have that have changed the rules and changed the landscape of our process. And I think that's also equally important to understand in all these paradigms and philosophy we're talking about, that's really changed a lot for all of us to really be mindful about, you know, that, wow, you know, it's a global village now. And everything's changed. Everything has started to change.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's, as you said, it's ultimately going to work out for the best, but there's going to be some, you know, shaky moments for some people, I would think.
There already are. I mean, I really think that there already are. And, yeah, there will be some shaky moments coming up, I think, in part for everybody. But they're a necessity to us being able to actually engage and take the next steps in our paths.
Oh, and, I agree. Totally.
You know, that's why we have to keep helping each other and speaking about it and, you know, sharing what we know with each other. And, I mean, I think it's all part of the process.
Well, it's so healing to have you on the show and have you share all of this information with everybody that's listening and who can listen to the archives later. So, you know, it's like sending a ripple out into the universe. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff that needs to be shared. And I can't be reminded enough about all of this.
Well, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure. I could talk for hours, obviously, but all this.
Well, I'll have to have you back because, you know, it's nice to have somebody who, you know, is able to you know, share what they feel and have strong thoughts about it. And plus, I agree with what you're saying. So, of course, I'm going to.
Yeah, most importantly.
It's like a mirror for my own views. And it's like, oh, yes, of course, talk all you want. But you're working on another book now?
I'm getting ready to put in a pitch to my publisher. We've already had a kind of a discussion about the idea that I have, and they seem to be pretty warm to it, so I'm going to be formalizing that in the next couple months.
Oh,
and
good.
It's, you know, you start getting ideas and they start downloading and then you know that something's trying to also come through again. So I'm kind of at that point. And I knew when I was writing it, my editor said, you know, you should really do a book just on soul esteem alone. And I was like, you know, that really would be a great thing to do. But, you know, when you're writing a book, you're like, yeah, let me just get through this one, you know?
Yeah, yep.
So, yeah, I'm going to go back to the drawing board before too long and get going on it. It's starting to come. And it's also part of, I'm not someone who can write something I don't feel I'm experiencing in my own process. And so it's sort of, you know, my life's work on my own journey also informs what I write, and that, and sort of
yeah,
works that way.
Absolutely. I cranked my first book out last year, and you know, it was a labor of love, and so I'm just kind of waiting for the inspiration for number two, you know. And like you said, it's your, you know, it's your path and your journey, and it kind of, it gets downloaded, and I'm starting to get little ideas and things, but it is quite a process.
It definitely is, and you know, I'm not so sure people really understand, unless you've written a book, what it really takes out of you and what it really asks of you in your life. I mean, it's something that you make sure you really want to.
Robert,
you know,
we're going
really
to
have something to say.
We're almost out of time, and I want you to mention your website so people can know where to find you.
Absolutely. My website is ohotto.com, which is OHOTTO.com, and you can go there and find out more about my work and read up on my book, and there's YouTube videos and all sorts of other stuff. I also have a radio show on Hay House that I do every other week, which is kind
wonderful.
Of fun. And
well, Robert, thank you so much for being on the show, and I'd like to have you back, and we can chat some more about things.
Absolutely, anytime.
All right,
thanks a lot.
Thanks a million, and I appreciate you being on tonight.
Okay, thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
All righty, good night.
Okay, take care.